Hello and welcome to Fix That, the podcast by The Fix Media, where we unpack media insight and take you behind the scenes of editorial decision, strategy, and innovation in the industry. I'm Orsi, and I will be your host today. Before we dive in, subscribe, follow, and if you like what you hear, support us at thefix.media. Final episode in this season before the holiday season, and I am so happy to welcome Marcela Kunova, Managing Director at Journalism UK, and of course Jakub Parusinski, founding editor from The Fix. And today we're going to talk about what happened this year and what the media sector can look forward in 2026. So I really would like to welcome our guests. Hello.
Right. Yeah. Hi, everyone, and thanks for having me, Orsi. My name is Marcela. I, as you said, am Managing Director at Journalism UK. Previously known as journalism.co.uk, which is a business-to-business publisher covering the media industry in the United Kingdom, published in English language. Now, we went through a rebrand this year, change of ownership, so I purchased the company, and I feel loads of the pain that many other news organizations are going through in terms of figuring stuff out for the years to come, and it's really a first hand, so I'm in a driver's seat for that. So you know, that gives me a pretty good vantage point where I'm not just talking about problems and solutions, I'm living them daily.
And my name is Jakub Parusinski. I'm the director of The Fix, also based in London, but I think The Fix, we tend to cover things a little bit more on the eastern half of the continent, so we're coming at sort of Europe from the two ends, because of the sort of the focus that we tend to have on Central and Eastern European media, and also I do have a role as well as a director of KI Insights within sort of the Cave Independence ecosystem, which looks at how news and sort of security issues, political issues develop in Ukraine. I'd say a year that's been very sort of driven by geopolitics. But can I just say, Marcela, it's always so encouraging and inspiring to hear about somebody actually making a deal in the media space. So first of all, congratulations on that. That's absolutely fantastic. But also sort of from a very kind of market perspective, you know, the fact that there's a deal in the media space means that somebody sees value in it, which is always a really encouraging sign. Not to sort of suggest that there isn't any, but it's always, you know, whenever there is something like that happens, it makes it all very tangible. So I think that's a really sort of positive place to start in a year that has been kind of tumultuous. But I guess we'll get into all of that.
And so yes, let's get into it. We have a very turbulent here, and with our two guests, who I suppose are very insightful. And I think if I think about like who I should ask about what happened this year in the media, then I would definitely like, that's why I invited you too, right? Because I would definitely like to hear it from someone who's actually living it through this chaotic year that we just had. So what do you think, looking back at 2025, what do you think, what was the best moment for media industry, like a milestone, an achievement, innovation that really inspired you? And it's very important that we start with the good news, and then we will go through of the pitfalls also of the last year.
Okay. I will talk about the shift that I observe, and I think the media industry is increasingly realizing that we need to collaborate more than we need to compete. Now, there are a few reasons for that. The one is obviously, I think I take the prize for being the first one mentioning AI. So the first is threat of generative AI and AI summaries and visibility and distribution. And I think after years of talking about it, this is the first time where media organizations realize we have bigger threats against us than each other. And if it's not collaboration because everyone thinks it's a smart idea, it can be a collaboration propelled by fear. If we don't do it, things will get worse. So do you see a shift in mindsets where people think about collaboration as beginning of the solution that we have to distribution of good journalism. I think good journalism is still there and has always been. We have massive, massive problem to get it to people and remain relevant. So the shift in mindset is something I've seen this year and that truly stood out to me.
That's definitely something really significant. I mean, yes, absolutely. And we might as well jump straight into the sort of the Gen AI discussion. So I'd be curious to understand how you sort of see this collaboration shaping up. I mean, I think there has been more. I definitely noticed something, which is, 2025, at the latest, it probably you could draw the line even earlier, is the death of thinking that we can just stretch the current model further and hope that better times will come. Because I think across virtually all the different publishers that I've spoken to, that I've run into, there's no longer a feeling that the status quo is sort of tenable. So you do need to adapt, you do need to innovate, you need to find new solutions, whether it's in the distribution side of things, the monetization side. I think it's actually been a year with a huge amount of creativity and innovation. A lot of media that are trying to test new things. There's a fair amount of throwing stuff against the wall and seeing what sticks. But definitely, I think there has been a huge mindset change. Now, as to the collaboration, I don't know, maybe I'm just didn't quite sort of feel that. I think there's discussions about it. Would you say that it's already moved towards something that's more tangible and that perhaps there's some sort of clear examples of where that's going?
Not yet, unless I don't know about it. So not yet. But where, I'm aware of informal conversations between editors and media owners where we are talking about what are we going to do about OpenAI and Anthropics and Perplexity and the rest of the summaries that are sucking up our work, your work, everyone's work, and regurgitate it without any clear value exchange. And I think that the value exchange is the problem. With Google, of course, there has always been the 10 links and the rest of it. But you could understand, you get traffic, you can monetize traffic, you can monetize advertising, etc. With Gen AI, the value exchange just isn't clear. And credits to Madhav Chinnappan, ex-Googler, who came up with the model of NATO for news and the idea of we need to collaborate. Now, how, I think this will materialize if regulation steps in as well. I think those two things need to go hand in hand because we need carrot and stick to talk with big tech companies. And the harsh reality is that they are in a much better position than media organizations to negotiate. We are not equal negotiating partners. So I think we need more than just collaboration. We, media sector, we need regulators on our side as well, where tech companies will be pushed from both sides. It's like, if you do it, you can gain this. If you don't do it, the consequences are much harsher than just you don't get content. Because one thing we can't forget is that we, as media organizations, we struggle to monetize our journalism. What do you think OpenAI will do with it? They're not going to monetize it either. So that's not financial value in access to news, and we have to realize that. So money is not going to flow from Anthropic or Perplexity the same way the traffic was flowing from Google. Monetizable traffic was flowing. So we do need to find an arrangement where we, I think, stop bleeding. But this is not source of revenue. But I think it's a very good kick up the butt for the media industry to realize we need to build those direct relationships with audience where we just stop relying on any tech, Google, Anthropic, whatever, to send us traffic and to monetize something. We need to find a way to monetize our journalism. And, we always had a paywall. It was called newspaper. and people were buying it. There was no other way, unless it was library or cafe. So we are not really reinventing anything, but we have to stop sitting there and wait for a technology to save us as an industry. And as I said, it either can be, for some people, can be exciting. For other people, they might just, be spurred to action through fear. But at some point, we just need to, just for the love of God, we need to do something.
Yeah. So I definitely agree with you. And by the way, the whole idea of, well, whether it's Google zero or at least Google significantly declining as a source of traffic for media, I think that's a crisis that we're already definitely in, right? It's already started. It's probably going to continue. And so, yes, the sort of the Gen AI story is not just a story of other forms of content coming out there and competing with the news, or journalists, pretending to report but actually getting most of their work from ChatGPT, which means that then you have to go in and sort of police your team, which is frankly rather annoying. But it's also a broader question about the system of where traffic comes from and so forth. And on that thought, I mean, one of the things that sort of strikes me in this year, and maybe it's a little bit anecdotal, but it feels like there's been a rise in sort of the professional subscription space, right? And, Politico Pro has been around for a while, Axios Pro has been around for a while, but I think they've really sort of grown in terms of their reach. There's a whole host of different publications that have launched their own sort of professional business-to-business, or at least sort of, services that are focused on more sort of high net worth subscribers. And I wonder if that's, it's essentially, for me, an answer to the fact, okay, exactly as you say, I do need to build a relationship with audiences that is direct, where you know the name of the people that you're writing to, or at least you know the institutions, you know their profile really well, you know exactly what is the type of news that gives them value and how to present it as well in a way that makes it valuable. And what I'm wondering is that something that will be quite restricted to this very sort of, to essentially the high end of the news spectrum, or is that something that we're just starting at the high end because that's where it's easiest to start to build this kind of model, and then it's going to go down the chain? Whichever side of the of that balance we land on, I think there's definitely been a to use the technical term, enshittification of anything that is sort of free content. It's all slop. It's all AI slop now. Whatever social media you go into, any sort of websites that are very, very cost optimized, it's just an endless outpour of really useless content. But I wonder to what extent is sort of proper news and high quality analyses, reporting, something that's really going to stay as essentially a luxury service or a premium service, or is that something that's sort of going to go down to the, at least, let's say, the middle classes, quote unquote.
I see that we already touched a little bit of everything that we wanted to cover for today. But now let's focus on what do you think, what was the most challenging or the most worrying moment for the media in 2025? Because I think we shifted a little bit from also how we look at AI in general now. Maybe now newsrooms are not so freaked out on it. But still, we had so many challenges this year. So what would you highlight as the biggest, let's say, shit show for 2025 for media sector?
Say sorry for the language, it's very appropriate. I have two. One is quite UK specific, one is more global stage. For UK, I think one of the biggest things that worry me is the consolidation of media ownership. I don't know how much you follow sort of UK news. There is a sale of the Telegraph, which is an institution. It will probably be bought by DMG Media, that already controls gigantic chunk of newspapers in the UK. So I think it's extremely dangerous if channels are narrowed down in small number of hands, especially, you know, whose interests are served and what gets reported and what gets ignored is directly tied to media ownership. We can't really pretend it's not. So that worries me. It doesn't mean actors are nefarious. It just means that less diversity in media ownership results in less diversity in how we serve our audiences. And that worries me greatly. Globally, it is the attacks on press freedom. I think it is, at least in English-speaking world, it's mostly seen in the US, where it's been going on for years, obviously, but now I think the President Trump's administration intensified its attacks on press. I don't know if you've seen the website that was launched on the White House, the page on the White House website about the offenders who report what President Trump disagrees with. I think creating this hostile attitude towards any checks and balances is extremely dangerous, not just for media, but for democracy. And I am worried how far can it escalate if trustworthy organizations who are the best place to hold power to account are undermined by this very power, and whether the audiences will have the gut and the money to step in and fight for their access to information.
I definitely think that the year for publishing has marched to the tune of politics, and specifically American politics, whether we like it or not. That's the drumbeat that ends up shaping the world. The discussions all over the world. Yeah, exactly. and I think, first of all, just sort of taking a regional perspective here. I mean, across sort of Central and Eastern Europe, one of the big disruptions was, of course, the cut to USAID at the very beginning of the year, which, frankly, I mean, I have, to be honest, mixed feelings about. Yes, that's a pool of money that is no longer available to publishers. On the other hand, it's the cuts to the USAID have led to thousands of jobs being lost by consultants in DC, and then actually not so many media being shut. Now, that doesn't mean that it hasn't been a problem for a lot of media to sort of compensate for that, and there has been a lot of belt tightening, and it's obviously not easy. But I think there's definitely a disproportion, and one of the things for me is, just to put it very clearly, the USAID sort of shutdown, I think, has raised question about the effectiveness of the donor support for media in general. And I think that's a rethinking that is long overdue. It's a hugely inefficient system. To be honest, in many cases, it causes as many problems as it resolves. So hopefully, we'll sort of try to solve that over the coming year. Looking beyond that, there's definitely been, once again, a sort of an assault on free media. I mean, even sort of internationally, it's not just a US phenomenon. I mean, we have Trump sort of suing or threatening to sue the BBC. That's definitely the sort of key message, is that once again, sort of people who provide independent reporting, analysis, and so forth are the enemies of whoever is in power. And I definitely think that the feud between Elon Musk and the European Union, which has just sort of broken out over the last couple of days, and is going to probably continue. I'd even wager a prediction that 2026 will see a pretty significant sharpening of that dispute. I mean, this is a global, a very global sort of fight of people who believe in this sort of postmodern MAGA-esque approach to running a country and a society versus people who believe in a division of powers that includes a fourth estate that is independent and sort of provides, news that is at least not aligned to those in power. Now, I mean, it's easily, the words independent, objective, they can be thrown around very easily. It's hard to always live up to them. In fact, it's impossible, right? Every story can always get a little bit better and so forth. But I think having sort of a split is quite important. And finally, I'd say one of the things that has been quite significant for me this year is, and again, this is a trend that this is something that builds on a longer trend, but we've seen a lot of both political actors and companies moving to direct-to-audience models. What do I mean by that? It's companies like Anderson Horowitz who are launching their own podcast so that they can, talk to potential investors or people in the VC community without sort of the interference of those pesky journalists asking them questions. It's, it's the MAGA movement embracing the podcast bros as a way to mobilize their audiences. It is, I mean, this is, last year, but I think it's a real embodiment of it. It's Tucker Carlson, freed from his network and running his own show on a combination of YouTube and Twitter, going to interview Vladimir Putin. And this is something, 10 years ago, unthinkable, right? That essentially a blogger, I mean, blogger no longer really sort of conveys the right, it's not quite the right word, but essentially a blogger goes and interviews a dictator who's in the middle of waging the biggest war in Europe since World War II. So I think that's something that we really see bear fruit this year with the inauguration of Trump, sort of on the wave of this kind of podcast-based mobilization of young voters. But it's something that continues to kind of grow. But maybe, and I guess we're going to shift towards some more optimistic issues, I think there has been a flip side to this, which is the discussion about media as an element of social resilience and media as an element even of defense spending, right? So more than once this year, we've sort of seen conversations of people saying, well, look, if society gets really disinformed and across Europe we're having hybrid threats, primarily from Russia, I suppose there's a little bit of China, North Korea, and other actors in the mix, but it is very much a Russian-led effort. Well, you're seeing no longer the free speech advocates, but also the men in uniform showing up and saying, "Well, hold on, there's a real problem with the level of information in our societies." And at this point, this is no longer something that's just annoying a bunch of journalists. This is something that is now a national security threat. So I think people are taking it more seriously. It's certainly the most chaotic time to be in publishing. But I guess that's if you said that every year for the last 5 years, that'd probably be true. So,
the main problem is that we are losing monopoly and we struggle to find another way. We used to be monopoly for traffic and advertising in the print time, where everything, newspaper was the best way to reach people, and we had monopoly of reach. That monopoly is gone with social and internet search. We used to have monopoly of information, where journalists were the one, finding and distributing information, and we lost this monopoly to social media, where we should have never ceded our place, I think, in the first place, and now the strong men and businesses of the world can bypass news industry entirely and get their message out. It's not even PR or advertorial. It is completely circumventing any media and just go to people directly. So I think, we, whether we like it or not, we might need to learn from this and see what works, because the audiences are there. And I don't think people reject the truth or don't want to know the truth. They just believe something else is true because it is served to them in the format they maybe seek out or understand, on platform they might seek out and understand. So I think our job as a journalist is to be in a spaces where people are looking for facts and looking for truth and populate those spaces with quality content, rather than, you know, shrinking into us. You know, it's us, the news, the journalism industry, and it has to be like it's always been 30, 40 years ago, and you just have to go back to what it used to be. It will never go back. It has changed. We don't have monopoly anymore, and we need to find a new way to fit within this ecosystem. I think that's one of the biggest challenges we have.
Can I, you mentioned the question of consolidation. So I was wondering if I can try to put forward a sort of a problematic, I'm not quite sure if it's a Hobbesian dilemma or what the exact term for it is, but there's definitely something about the need to retake the space and the different elements of what publishing is away from the companies and actors who have sort of filled in the gaps or sort of pushed publishers out. So I definitely agree with that part. The question that I'm wondering about is whether a collection of independent media is able to do that, or if it's not more likely to be successful if it is a consolidated group of a few very powerful players, right? To sort of like really kind of go into this, these two alternative scenarios, I believe there's a phrase in sort of the series Succession, which I imagine a lot of people who are fans of publishing have watched, with amusement or horror, depending on how they felt about it. But there is this sort of motive that comes back through it, that, you know, what they want to do through all of these consolidation plays is to have one last great publishing player to stand up against tech. Right. And I think that phrase comes back a couple of times. So if you had to pick between these two rather unappealing alternatives, Marcella, how would you feel? Would you prefer a Rupert Murdoch-esque kind of character leading a consolidated media player against sort of the tech companies, the political actors and so forth, retaking a space for publishing? Or a situation in which this the space in which publishing thrives getting ever smaller and sort of being starved out of it?
Well, Jakub, thankfully, as always, when we have this dual fallacy, there is a third solution, which is neither. And no, I do not prefer Rupert Murdoch in any scenario. But what we can do is to have alliance, and I would talk alliance rather than consolidated ownership, because it is possible to collaborate while still preserving your work or your business or your audience or whatever it can be. Alliances work. You know, we can have European Union, which is not a state, but it's a union, and it has a negotiating power that individual states don't have. We don't have to all merge into a same state, to borrow another sort of phrase from politics, to have this negotiating power. And I don't think one strong man taking everything, either voluntarily given up or not. And I think you can talk about that better than me. In the end of the day, I think consolidation always results in hostility inside those who do not want to be part of this one big chunk. We don't live in an era where journalists have only two choices: work for a strong man or be nobody. You can go and set up your Substack. Yes, you will have maybe less influence, but you can do whatever you want and do it better. So, you know, seeing the fragmentation of the industry, I think this strongman scheme doesn't work anymore. And we have to be much smarter about what we do. And I do believe we can form a body where we can collaborate while still having diversity of voices and geographies and way of serving our audience. We can be smarter about the way we work for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, so first of all, I think that was a very deft response to sort of a very unappealing dilemma and a good way out of it. I do agree. I think there's a lot of room for sort of this more sort of community/alliance approach. Maybe just to tease out a couple of those things or just to push back a little bit for the sake of argument. I think, I mean, absolutely, I agree that the European Union is an interesting example here. I think one of the challenges that people will bring up is that, yes, so the European is a good way to respond to some of these threats. But as we see right now with the pressure coming from the US, from Russia, from China, and the European Union being stuck in this very difficult sort of geopolitical situation, I think I've heard several MEPs recently use the phrase the curse of consensus, is that that the need for consensus is something that holds back the EU from being able to move at the speed and make decisions as quickly enough to sort of respond to some of the threats. So there's a question. Yes, this is definitely a valid model. Will it be enough? Right. And then I think, not all the strong men need to be sort of quite as bad as Rupert Murdoch. I mean, you might sort of have your disagree. I'm sure a lot of people do. But I think Matthias Döpfner would probably be the more interesting sort of example, although he's actually expanded to the U.S. quite a bit, more with an anti-China perspective based on his statements. But there's probably something there. There's a question whether we need somebody from the media sector to sort of stand up for European interests and European ways of governing speech and press, right? So I think I agree with the point around the alliances. I'm still sort of a little bit, concerned that a lot of people, well, let me put it this way. Substack is great and all the social media opportunities to distribute content are great, but they make you even more dependent on a small group of tech players. And ultimately, for me, it's a question of, can I get enough talented, smart, and motivated people in a dense sort of format, in a room, in an organization, whatever you want to call it, so as to be able to solve some of the challenges that are coming our way? And I guess that's the question where, well, if you can do that within an alliance, that's all good, and that's probably the best option. The question is, would you be able to do that, and can you sort of pull enough talented people? And the answer probably is yes. But sort of looking beyond that, just maybe 2026, and Orsi, I don't know how much you want to talk about the next year as well. What would you think are the sort of the big topics that are coming up for let's say Perugia next year? It's always a bit of a indicator of where the year is headed. What are the headlines that are popping up in Italy? What do you think the International Journalism Festival 2026 is going to be led by? Obviously, Gen AI is going to be a big one. What are the other topics?
Other than generative AI, the last Perugia, I was very surprised by the amount of discussions that were very sort of anti-AI hostility, as if it were something we can like keep at bay. It is not. It penetrated every single area of life of our users, even if it's not what we want. It sets up user expectations. Like, it's not something we can shut out and ignore and pretend it's not happening by not adopting it. We need to tame it as a beast. So I hope this year we will talk about solutions of how to deal with AI rather than position these talks as something that is avoidable. And this almost militaristic spirit of fighting with AI, I don't think it's constructive. It's, you know, you can't put genie back in a bottle. It's out. We need to find a way to adapt. I don't say adapt means adopt everything, but we need to be just very smart about how the world is working. And I hope to see less venting on stage and more constructive ideas of what we can explore, what work and what doesn't, and perhaps adapt it to different sizes of organizations and different geographies and different audiences that we serve. Other than that, hopefully we keep the attentional audience and audience centricity of journalism. We'll probably see more about the creator economy, again, an ignorable force. And, you know, I do understand the value of a bitch-a-thon when people sort of come together and they can vent for a little bit. But I think it's more constructive if we keep that off stage and bring in the brains from everywhere in the world to talk about solutions rather than just complain about the state of things. That's my wish.
Like in the episode, sounds like we're a great match and we couldn't be happier. If you'd like to strengthen our bond, support us by donating or joining our membership program. That's it. No more interruptions. Back to the episode.
Connecting to what's going to happen next year, of course, beside the media festival, what do you think? So what's waiting us in 2026?
If I had an answer for that, I would monetize it. I think the fragmentation will continue, and it's something that deeply worries me, and I don't have any solution for that. And fragmentation, I mean, both of industry and of audiences. You know, on the one hand, we see the creator economy taking off, and very often for very good reasons. If you remove the baddies, there are still very, very good journalists who do actual genuinely good journalism in the creator space, be it newsletters or, you know, social, YouTube, TikTok, whatever it can be. And I think audiences do often prefer this format, not just because they have low attention span, but also because it is truly personalized to them. You know, it's someone in flesh and bone that speaks to them, explains stuff, helps them understand, and it just feels useful. And my worry about this fragmentation is not just all the obvious things, monetization and you know, regulation and the rest of it, but also I think as a society, we are creating this hyper-personalized, fragmented reality, and we don't share reality anymore. And it's something that media have massive power in. You know, if it was whatever, sports match or, you know, Christmas ads, whatever it could be, right? They used, you know, the TV show that everyone was watching, or, you know, radio show, whatever that could be. There was a sense of some kind of shared collective reality that we could agree on, disagree on, you know, bitterly argue about it. But at least we knew what the other person was talking about. Now when, you know, every other person is with the headphones on their own podcast and, you know, reading on phone, I think the experiences of people who live next to each other can be radically different. And I just don't know where we need to position ourselves in this space, because we know that personalization helps us get to people, but then we are contributing to this fragmentation of this sort of shared reality, of the shared rituals that I think one way or another hold the society together. And I'm worried about it, because media used to have this. There was another thing, if it didn't have monopoly, at least we have a very important role in that. And I see this influence slipping away from us through this fragmentation. And I do worry about what this will mean for our society, full stop, not just democracy, but just the way we live with each other, how this hyper fragmentation, hyper personalization just influence the way we live. And I, as a media industry, I don't really know where we should position ourselves. And I don't know whether sitting with one bum on two chairs really works. I think we need to make a decision somehow. And that kind of both worries and excites me. And I think one of the challenges will be work this out. And I kind of look forward to seeing the solutions that publishers will come up with and see what works, what doesn't.
I thought that was incredibly well put. This is something that really is, it's crazy to think just how far things or how deeply things have changed. Some time ago, and I think I'm, sad to say, but I think it is now sort of decades ago, a story or the sort of national publication in a given country was creating that shared experience. I think it has sort of slowly attrited. Now, if I think, it's not even about a shared reality, but about shared experiences that people can relate to. And just given how fragmented everybody is, I mean, if you ask somebody below a certain age, the one shared experience that they have is sort of everyone has seen a couple of TikToks, right? And then people above that age. I think the last time that there was something that was like fairly common across, a really broad part of society is, I'm thinking back to sort of the initial launch of Stranger Things and Game of Thrones. I think that's something that really, that was a moment that a lot of people were sort of tuned into sort of the same one sort of shared experience that most people can relate to. I really struggled to find a moment that would come from the publishing space that would bring that, although in the past there were. As to what that means for the business models, I'm sort of cautiously optimistic about that, actually. So one thing, and also sort of speaking from own experience and, shameless plug here, a little while back, together with a couple of colleagues, we decided to launch it's essentially something like a pro version for the Kyiv Independent, KA Insights. And the idea is that there's a very small community of people. We're talking about several dozen, maybe up to 100 people around the world that are very, very interested in understanding, specific issues about Ukraine's sort of political or security space. And essentially, putting out by sort of building this very small community at quite a high price point in terms of the subscription, we managed to get people who are very busy to give us an hour or two of their time per week, receiving, frankly, like 10 pages of dense analysis, like here's the things that happened over the last week. And the feedback couldn't be better. I'm struggling to remember a time with a publication where I would get such sort of feedback about like, oh, this was really useful. This was really actionable. It helped me inform sort of my specific decision-making over the week. And it feels like something that is sort of like what you aspire to with journalism. But then, yes, it absolutely does run into the point of, well, this isn't for the public. This is for a very narrow walled garden of sort of subscribers who are all vetted even. It's not just a question of paying the money. It's like, we sometimes get subscriptions and we assume that, well, we don't know what this person's interests are, and whether they're on the good or the bad side of the issue. So maybe we're not going to sort of add them to our list. And so, essentially, it becomes a little bit more like the sort of the restaurant scene. So there are there's journalism for the masses, the fast food. And, it has its advantages. It's accessible. It's cheap. It's, quite efficiently produced. And then there are really bespoke and complex products that are created for a very niche audience. And, you know, sometimes that niche audience is so small that you even have to wait to be able to get a seat there. And I think that's a great way to sustain knowledge and people and sort of develop. And I think that it is fairly independent of even the tech infrastructure, because if you can have all of your subscribers in a WhatsApp group or on an email distribution list, well, that gives you a lot of security about the connection with them. But then, yeah, it comes at the cost of a shared reality. Absolutely.
You know what, in a really cheesy way, to play on your restaurant metaphor and how that shared reality worries me, is that, I mean, I don't know how in other parts of the world, but I see restaurants being increasingly empty and roads completely covered in delivery and just eat motorcycles that are getting food straight to people's homes. So rather than sharing a space in a restaurant and enjoying our meal, we all just get it delivered when we want, how we want, what we want into our homes. And again, this fragmented reality, you can see it even with something as simple as restaurants. And it almost doesn't matter which end of the food you consume, whether it's a burger or a fine meal, the personalization and fragmentation is definitely affecting, I think, every sector.
Slowly we are finishing this episode, so maybe as a last question, let's think about the New Year's Eve wish, because there is no New Year's Eve without a wish. So what do you think, if you could have one wish, if you could make one wish for the media sector in 2026, what that would be?
I wish journalists approached challenges in our industry with the same curiosity they approach their stories, and wonder about the problems and wonder about the audience and look for solutions or look for experts. And truly, you know, we have all the skills. We are curious, we fact check, we sense bullshit, we are creative. We have all the skills we need to solve this industry's problems if we stop ignoring them or wishing them to go away or just being sort of militaristic about it, or just try to sort of push again or just go back to the golden age that never existed. Embracing challenges and treat them like stories with all that fantastic skills you all have. We can do it. I mean, people are so clever. And I wish we treat our problems like stories.
That was such a great answer. I wanted to say curiosity myself, so I'm going to have to look for something different. I would say my hope is that media can do a better job at marketing themselves. This is sort of my longstanding grievance. I think that media disregard marketing, they confuse marketing and distribution. Just because you have a million followers on Twitter doesn't mean that you have marketing. You actually need to communicate your brand, your values, why you're an interesting place to work at. And so I hope that we become better at that, because I think it does solve a lot of our problems. I think it mobilizes audiences. I think it excites people to come and work at media, and that is probably the biggest long-term risk for the industry. And I think it just sort of helps us, just makes it so much easier at clawing back some of those elements of the media, some of the kind of the instruments and the capabilities the media had in the past, and that have frankly just been given away to other actors without too much thought, more often than not. So I hope that we do a better job of selling ourselves.
All right. Thank you for being a guest today at Fixed.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much.
To everyone listening, thanks for tuning into Fixed. Subscribe wherever you get your podcast, follow the Fix online, and yes, we're now also on TikTok. Want to support our work? Visit thefix.media and explore our new membership program.